Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for dropping along tonight, where Dr. Martin Parkinson makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. I think it's his third appearance at the Sydney Institute, and we're very grateful to have so significant a senior public servant finding time to address us tonight. He's well known to many of you, so I will introduce our speaker briefly. Dr. Parkinson was educated at Adelaide, the ANU and Princeton Universities. He's held many senior positions in the public service, but probably most notably in recent times, the Secretary of the Department of Climate Change, of the Department of Treasury, and currently, of course, is the Secretary of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet since 2016. And the topic tonight is technological change, making the most of the technological revolution. Dr. Parkinson, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Jared. Let me begin by acknowledging the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, traditional owners of the land on which we gather tonight, and I allow me to pay my respects to their elders past and present. Thank you for that very warm welcome, Jared, and thank you to Anne as well for inviting me to speak. The Sydney Institute is 28 years young, and I want to acknowledge the extraordinary contribution it's made in supporting national debate over this period. Last time I spoke at a gathering of the Institute, it was as head of the Treasury, and my topic then was the challenge of fiscal sustainability. Tonight, I want to focus more on the profound impacts of the current wave of technological disruption. And my message is very simple. We're on the cusp of unprecedented technological change. Done right, this technological revolution will drive the next wave of jobs and growth in productivity and our living standards. Harnessing this change to build a just and productive Australia is going to be one of the most fundamental challenges for Australia's leadership, for government, for the public service, for the business sector, and for the community more generally. So let me begin by looking backwards. In the broad sweep of history, technological disruption is something that's relatively new. Now, it sounds odd for those of us who are alive today and what we've been used to, but for the vast majority of human generations, people would never have expected technology to improve living standards appreciably over the course of their life, and nothing at all approaching the rate of change that we see today. In the 3,000 years before the Industrial Revolution, per capita income in what we would think of as the advanced economies of the time had barely moved. And now, since the 1800s, per capita income in the advanced economies of today has risen by more than 3,000%. Technology, by which we simply mean advances in manufacturing and machinery and agricultural science and medical science and transport and communications, has revolutionised our lives. It's given us extraordinary productivity growth. And as a direct result, we live longer, we're healthier, and we're richer. And even though it may not feel like it to some of us, we work less. The average work week in highly industrialised Western economies today is roughly half of what it was in the 19th century. It's fallen from around 60 hours a week on average in 1870 to about 30 hours a week today. But change is a continuous process, even if it occurs in fits and spurts. For example, it's difficult to imagine life without smartphones. Yet this ubiquitous device, the iPhone, is just 10 years old. But think about what this one piece of technology has done in 10 years. It's changed the way we shop, it changed the way we communicate, and it's even changed the way we conduct political discourse and debate. Industries are being disrupted everywhere. Witness the impact of Uber on the taxi industry, or the stranding of landline telecoms in the face of the rapid proliferation of internet, Wi-Fi and cell phones. Technology has significantly reduced the cost to produce, market and distribute many goods and services. It's allowed places that were geographically isolated to actually be part of an integrated global economy. It's given consumers incredible choice, and it's increased supply by allowing people to market their own resources, because that's essentially what they're doing when they're putting a room on Airbnb or they're getting in their car and driving for Uber. Technology is also making it easier to start new businesses, which is increasing competition across many markets. The late William Beaumont, who was himself a famous Princeton economist, said that markets could be contestable even if they have only one provider. Now, we would normally think of that as a monopoly. But Beaumont's point was, as long as the barriers to entry and exit were relatively free, so relatively free on the way in and relatively costless on the way out, the very threat of an entrant would actually provide the sort of outcome that actual competitors would do. And today, in part due to technology, business startup costs are lower than they've ever been. But technology has also empowered people. Think about inventions like cochlear implants or artificial limbs. These have meant that people with disabilities can now participate far more fully in our society. So technology here isn't about increasing wealth or changing the types of products, but it's actually about giving people a platform, giving a platform to those people who in the past may not have actually had it. Now, the Industrial Revolution was not just a technological revolution. Culture and institutions matter, and culture and institutions matter far more than people give them credit for. Economic historian Joel Mulca says the Industrial Revolution happened in Europe because of the culture of ideas fostered by the debate and diversity of thought that those culture and those organisations, those institutions that characterise Europe were actually fostering. And you could say, well, that's then, what about now? Well, think about China's recent past. It wasn't until China opened up to market forces in the 1970s that it was really able to make proper use of modern technology. And since it did open up, it's generated economic growth rates of 9.7% a year on average since 1980. That is a phenomenal thing. Think about what had happened to China after the Communist Revolution through to the opening up in the late 70s. And then think about what's happened since 1980 till today, where China's real income has grown dramatically. And indeed, its economy is arguably the largest in the world, and if not, is about to become the largest in the world. Now, coming back to my core point, we're on the cusp of a further period of technological disruption. Klaus Schwab of the World Economic Forum has called this the fourth industrial revolution. And what he means is that technologies like artificial intelligence, like robotization and blockchain are going to revolutionise the way in which societies create and distribute wealth. In other words, put it prosaically, we ain't seen nothing yet. Indeed, our chief scientist, Alan Finkel, has argued that reading science fiction is about your best guide to the future. Not to predict what will happen, but to encourage the sort of creativity to imagine what might be. Now, this is our opportunity as a country to drive a new wave of national productivity. But realising this opportunity and doing it in our terms to sustain a just and productive Australia is our challenge. And it's not a challenge for the political class, it's not a challenge for the business community, it's not a challenge for the public service, it's not a challenge for the broader community. It's a challenge for all of us. So tonight what I wanted to do was talk about it, because I think it's time we had a frank conversation about some of these issues. Make no mistake, no fundamental change to the economy and society of the sort that could be envisaged under the fourth industrial revolution will be easy or uncontested. We need to be unashamedly ambitious about this technological revolution, about the opportunities it will provide to drive growth, to create new jobs, and to improve our life choices. But we also need to ensure that this is a very human revolution, one that's consistent with enduring Australian values. The first challenge, is that technology will continue to have significant impacts on the labour market. That's an economist's way of saying that technology will profoundly change the sort of jobs available to us, to our kids and to our grandkids, and both in terms of what we do and in terms of how much we get paid. There are going to be massive new opportunities, new occupations that we cannot dream of, new industries that we cannot imagine, but also increased options in existing industries. But despite this, people are nervous, and that's understandable, because there are going to be potential consequences, and we need to have an honest discussion about the range of ways in which workers might be worse off. Some may be unable to compete with technology, and their jobs may be made technologically redundant. This is what happened to all of those people who were blacksmiths and farriers once we started to electrify production processes and Henry Ford mass-produced cars, and we started to displace horses off the street. Other workers could see flat wage growth, perhaps because they're in industries where technology does not expand demand as prices fall, or simply because there's more competition for those workers in the sorts of jobs they can do because machines have freed up labour that would otherwise have done different jobs. That is, so it's not that necessarily technology's disrupted directly the job I'm doing, but the job Jared's doing has now gone out of business, so Jared now competes with me for the job that I'm pursuing. Indeed, there is a very interesting question here, which is that will technological disruption ultimately be disinflationary? And if you think about the challenges that we've had, in our lifetime, we've worried about inflation, and we've wrung our hands a lot in the last decade or so, post the GFC, about disinflationary tendencies. But could it be the fact that the technological change that we're about to see is in fact going to embed disinflationary pressures more broadly? I have absolutely no idea what the answer to that question is, but I think it's one that's worth us thinking about. There are also concerns that the security of a full-time job may be replaced by a series of one-off jobs, the so-called gig economy. And if that's true, it's going to mean that we'll need to think about how we approach areas like retirement income policy and the way financial institutions assess credit, especially for housing, in quite different ways. And these are going to be quite significant policy challenges for us. Not today, not tomorrow, but if one looks out over the decades ahead, if some of these developments occur, we'll have to think about some of these areas. The important point I want to leave you with, though, is that none of those challenges that I've described is insurmountable. If we recognise the human stories behind the economic terms that we will describe them with. Having been a Treasury official in the early 1980s, I'm acutely aware that many of the people who lost their jobs in the last recession, and these were largely middle-aged men, they never found stable long-term employment again. And we don't want to have technological revolution that inadvertently leads to that. So let me go back to the point that these sorts of changes I'm talking about are going to bring massive opportunities. Yet, if you look at the paper, if you look at the media, what do you get? You get the impression of this dystopian challenge, fear-mongering about the future. We all should sort of be terribly scared about what's coming. I think that is just absolutely sending the wrong message to the Australian community. Fundamentally, a positive technological shock, which is what we're talking about, lifts national income. How it gets distributed across all the individuals in the society is a matter for the society to determine. I've said it in the past, and Ted Evans, one of my predecessors as Treasury Secretary, said it famously, societies choose the rate of unemployment they want by the way in which they determine their labour market regulations. Equally, we can choose the rate of inequality we want. And the challenge for us is to think about how you weigh up the response to some of these potential risks against the potential opportunities. Technological change, though, tends to eliminate tasks, not whole jobs, and that's really important. So as long as we can train our people to be able to adapt to new technology, the future is very promising. Let me give you a really prosaic example. Machines now count and dispense money at banks. Who has been into a bank to go to a bank teller recently to get cash out? Oh, we got one. Yep. Okay. Now, what happens if I tell you there are now more bank tellers in the US today than there were 40 years ago? What's happened? They're not counting cash, but they are providing customer service and client relationships. They're doing things that are more creative. And that's the issue for us here. We have the opportunity to create many more jobs that require a bit of creativity and human interaction while we actually automate some of the more mundane activities. So it's worth being really clear on a couple of points because you see these stories all the time in the press. The first is there is no evidence that technology has reduced the total number of available jobs in Australia. Now, how do you square that with the fact that shock, horror, insert company name here, is laying off X thousand workers over the next 3 years? It's because we're actually producing 7,000 new jobs a week on average. So 7,000 new jobs a week. The second thing that's worth responding to is the fear of the gig economy. Well, it may happen, but everybody's talking about it as if it's already happened. And in fact, technology has not led to any increase in the casualisation of the workforce. About 20% of all people at work have working casual roles, and that is unchanged over the last decade. So let's take on this issue that can technology drive inequality? Since the 1980s, incomes in poor countries have been rising, which means that the world has become more equal. The flip side, though, is there's been rising inequality inside many advanced economies. Some of this does seem to have been due to the impact of new technologies that have allowed emerging countries to export goods previously made in advanced economies. New telecoms technologies have allowed services to move across borders, and they may now be about to do the same to some middle-skilled workers. And as I mentioned, there is a risk that we have to acknowledge that the fourth industrial revolution will sharpen inequality between those who can and those who cannot harness new technology in their lives and their jobs. We're also yet to see if the mega tech firms, the Amazons, the Alibabas, the Apples and Googles, will become the robber barons of the last century. Will become the modern equivalent of the robber barons of the last century. Though I'd like to think that modern regulatory institutions will significantly reduce that risk. But again, I'd caution against dystopian predictions that technology will make us all redundant, or society will become more unequal, or will become more monopolistic. Think about a world where the intellectual property of mega platforms is able to be replicated and bettered by new competitors. And the digital economy provides new opportunities for workers. You think, well, actually, how can that happen? Well, who remembers AOL? Wasn't that long ago that AOL was perceived to be the cutting edge? It's gone. Look at Nokia. Back before the iPhone, Nokia actually dominated the mobile phone market. Nokia is now not a significant player. So these things can change and change very rapidly. So I want to make another point here, though, about inequality. Because unlike in many comparable countries, there is no evidence of marked rises in income inequality in Australia. Now let me repeat that. There is no evidence of marked rises in income inequality in Australia. Now, it is true that rising house prices have changed the distribution of wealth, and that is an important distinction. But if you look at income growth since 1986, it's averaged 50% across, and has been broadly similar across all household quintiles. That is, if you divide all households into slices of income, top 20%, next 20%, so on, the growth since 1986 has been broadly comparable. And that stands in really sharp contrast to the experience of, say, the United States, where nobody other than the very, very top end of the income distribution has seen a rise in household incomes. Why? Well, in part, demand from Asia boosted demand for jobs across the entire skill spectrum in Australia, first in mining and energy, then construction, and now in services. But equally, our education and school systems have done a reasonable job of channeling workers in the right jobs, and our social safety nets, our tax and welfare systems, have been well placed to support those who have needed temporary support through a period of adjustment, or even those that have required more permanent assistance. The challenge for us is to ensure that all of those systems remain fit for purpose as this technological disruption occurs. The third challenge we face, though, is broader. Technology is changing the nature of the political and public debate in ways that are often difficult to respond to or anticipate. As I said before, technology is able to empower people who previously didn't have voice. This is undoubtedly a good thing. But while social media offers a tremendous platform to build support for campaigns, it's hardly conducive to considered, respectful, and balanced discussion about complex issues. I know it's unfair to blame technology for the modern era of reform malaise across many advanced economies, but we do have to recognise that many liberal democracies are struggling to take tough but necessary decisions in a social media age. The ability to create communities of interest defined only by what they're against, rather than the sort of breadth of things that they're for, makes thoughtful policy development much, much harder than it has been in the past. Now, I don't want to suggest that in the 1980s it was easy. It's not. It was different. The difference is now that public institutions are yet to master these new platforms, and we have to do that. We have to find ways to master them so that we can build public trust in our competence and our integrity and generate better solutions and public buy-in for complex problems, rather than allowing these platforms to be used to infantilise the nature of the debate. And we've still got a fair way to go to get to that point. Now, all of this shows, I think, the enormous opportunities, but the realistic challenges that the new technological revolution is going to present to Australia. So I want to focus on three critical areas for our collective leadership if we are to sustain the just and productive Australia that we've created. First, we need to recognise that over the next quarter century, technology will be perhaps the most significant driver of jobs, national productivity, and living standards. To thrive in this world, Australian business has to be smart, has to be innovative, and has to be ambitious. As such, each industry will probably face its own Kodak moment. None can rest on past success. What do I mean by that? Kodak thought that people wanted better prints. They thought that the trick was to invest in higher and higher quality film because that would be what gave them the edge. And in fact, what people really wanted was to be able to store their memories. And if you could give them a better way to store their memories that was cheaper and allowed them to do things far more quickly and simply, which is essentially what digital cameras did, then Kodak were not well prepared. Henry Ford says, if you ask consumers what they wanted, they would tell you they wanted faster horses. Well, in actual fact, what they really wanted when it was offered to them was motor vehicles. So wherever you look, industries are going to face these sorts of challenges. But it's not just industries. It's the government and the public sector that face exactly the same challenge. And rather than seeking to slow the adoption of technological change, in many ways, and it might sound perverse, the best thing for us to do is to disperse that technology faster still. Because that will be how we will be able to retain our competitive edge. That and being open to trade, investment and highly skilled foreign workers. We need to be realistic. As a country of over 24 million in a world of 7.5 billion, most of our technology is going to be and will continue to be imported. Governments at all levels have a role in helping citizens take advantage of that with access to infrastructure like high-speed internet and data and cyber security capabilities. Needless to say, our regulatory structures also need to spread technological opportunities while making sure the technological revolution is one that works for all Australians. Now, I mentioned the gig economy before. Best estimates suggest there are already something in the region of 100,000 Australians currently doing gig jobs with online platforms like Uber and Airtasker. Almost inevitably, these numbers are going to grow. The newness of these platforms means, though, that we're still grappling with their implications. They've increased competition, they've driven down price, and they've given consumers increasing options. But for many workers in traditional jobs, they've also created a fear of what their rise might mean for their own wages and conditions. And we've seen responses around the world. Uber, for example, has been banned in London. Airbnb is banned in New York. In Australia, the Fair Work Ombudsman is investigating Uber to see whether their workers should be subject to the same wage regulations as traditional employees. We do have to scrutinise carefully regulation in these areas. But we also have to be really clear that if what we're doing is restricting technological take-up, we may in fact be stopping the solution to some of the challenges. E.g., service quality and safety may actually be improved if we're able to put more transparency and more immediate real-time feedback into the market so that consumers can see, if I go to this doctor for a hip replacement, how does he compare with this doctor over here? Does she have a superior record? Now, as a consumer, I'd love to be able to know that sort of information, but I can't get hold of it today. So there are some things there which we will need to carefully think about whether the regulatory environment's right. But we also have to recognise that protections for workers' conditions are important manifestations of Australian values, of the Australian social compact, if you will. The challenge is to ensure that those regulations don't stop new ways to provide entry-level work for those who might otherwise miss out. Over the next quarter century, we'll need to fundamentally transform the way that government does business to fuel productivity and innovation in areas like health, education and social services. Federal, state and local public services employ 16% of the workforce, that is nearly 2 million workers, and we're responsible for 35% of GDP. Even marginal improvements in productivity and outcomes in those sectors will have massive beneficial impacts on Australia's performance over time. Now, for us to do that, it's going to be critical that we get much better at using data and being far more creative in the use of digital platforms. You are creative in the use of digital platforms. You're all doing this. You're Facebooking, you're FaceTiming or Skyping with your grandkids, you're emailing your friends and like. Government has been slow to respond to this. And this is true of government at all levels in most countries. That means that we have to invest more upfront in systems and capabilities. It means that we also need to think about more targeted policy interventions, more targeted services, more targeted regulatory interventions. And how can we actually do that? Well, we're holders of massive volumes of information. But I'm sure if I asked you, would you be happy with government using the information that it has on you, you'd be far more reluctant to say yes than you would be to say yes to Facebook and Google and others. And that's going to be one of the challenges. How do we, if you as citizens are more willing to share information with a for-profit corporate entity than you are with government, how do we actually create trust in the use of data so that we can more effectively use the data that is available to actually better deliver outcomes for citizens and for business? At the same time as unleashing opportunity, though, there's an abiding responsibility for our collective leadership to ensure change doesn't fracture that enduring social compact that I mentioned, because it's that social compact that underpins Australian democracy. We can't afford to simply leave people behind. Practically, this means we've got to have an education and school system that helps workers use technology rather than be replaced by it. Perhaps this means more continuous, lifelong learning. Probably, it means being more human, that is, with more abstract, creative thinking and interpersonal contact, less knowledge and rote learning, because robots will be able to do that better, using information rather than necessarily compiling it. But whether that perhaps and that probably are correct, it is certainly going to be the case that a high-quality education system available to all and one which is responsive to the changing needs of the economy and society will be critical. And that won't be an either-or in terms of the economy and society. It will be both, responding to the needs of both. And we need particular support for those that are left out, which will be a challenge, as I said earlier, for our tax and transfer system. Because we'll have to find ways to ensure that we provide adequate incomes while also not dampening the incentives we need to create for people to participate. Coming back to this issue, though, of government and institutions needing to earn trust in a new digital world, I think, Jared, this is a topic for a speech of its own, so I'm not going to go here tonight. But I do think one takeout is that earning trust requires institutions to be able to demonstrate both competence and integrity, both a real impact and a evident beneficial intent. You cannot just rely on saying, well, we're trying to do our best for you. I've actually got to show that it's actually making you better off. And it's not enough to simply say, well, look, you're now better off. You have to have understood that I was trying to do that for your benefit. Results matter, in other words. Now, let me finish on a positive note. Back in the 1870s, US newspapers were party political and full of rhetoric. But technology helped moderate that by improving the productivity of printing. As the price of paper fell, competition increased, and newspapers became more responsive to what readers wanted compared to what owners wanted to produce. Newspapers, in fact, became informative and independent. Technology, in that case, helped break control over information. And in turn, go back to that reference I made to the robber barons of the 1800s, that actually helped limit the corruption of that gilded age. Part of the disenchantment people may feel with liberal democracy today could have similar sorts of antecedents. Technology is driving down the cost of information. It is increasing the diversity of opinion even further. And while this freedom may make policy harder, and herding cats comes to mind, we should all cherish it as something that's fundamental to our national values, because not all countries do. And we need to remember who we are and where we've come from. So if I can leave you with a message, it's we should not be fearful of change, but hopeful about what it can bring, and hopeful about how we can use it to shape and strengthen our nation's best qualities and aspirations. Thank you very much.
Many thanks to Dr. Parkinson for a very thoughtful presentation this evening, and very interesting look at the future. So we come to question and discussion, and we'll finish no later than top of the hour. So Richard, just can Dr. speak loudly.
Yep. Dr. Parkinson, Australia seems to have a trend of decreasing education achievement, which is the very opposite of what you say that we need as a nation, particularly in the case of the humanities as opposed to the STEM subjects. What do we do to turn this around so that a more realistic and honest appreciation of history in particular becomes part of the way in which school children and university students understand about our past? If you don't understand the past, you'll fail in the future.
I think it's a very good question. I think there are two separate things intertwined there, so let me take them separately. The one is, what should the curriculum cover? I think you're right to say, if you don't know your history, then you're destined to... you're not destined, but you're at risk of repeating things you should have actually learnt the lessons of. But I'm not going to buy into the issue of what should be in the curriculum. I think the more important thing is that whatever we want to teach our kids, we've got to have the best teachers doing it. And it's actually teacher quality and autonomy in the schools that is the critical issue. And that's why David Gonski's work is so important. For the first time ever, we actually have a needs-based approach to education that applies on a national level, and the work that that David is doing now, it will actually go to that very issue of how do we improve teacher quality. How do we get better outcomes, and the role of teacher quality, of greater autonomy for principals and the like in that. I suspect, and I haven't seen any of his preliminary work, I suspect, though, that will come out with a very, very strong message. Whereas if you think about what the debate in Australia has been, it's all been about smaller class sizes. That apparently if you can just drive down the size of the class, then somehow magically, whether the teacher is actually capable or not, doesn't matter. But it's actually about teacher capability.
There's a question up there. I'll take you in water.
I agree with all you've said, no problems there. But it's very interesting that in the last couple of years, probably one of the top schools in Sydney, Sydney Grammar, has banned computers from the classroom, and other educational heavies have said that in the Western world, countries that have invested heavily in computer education have seen no improvement in their scholastic standards. So where do we draw the line between our obsession with technology and how it's going to change our lives, and it has, and all the rest of it, and other fundamentals that we really can't afford to lose, when really top educationists are saying there's a lot of money wasted on technology?
No pressure
on that side, is it? Are we better off with IT in the classroom? I'm not an educationist, so I'm not going to hazard an answer definitively one way or the other. But it's a pretty odd thing to think that you would ban IT from the classroom and yet have the kids walk out of the classroom and be fully immersed in it. So I think with all of these things, the challenge is to get the balance right. And inevitably we know that what happens is the pendulum swings too far one way, and then it's at risk of swinging too far back the other way. And it needs, I go back again, it needs open and honest debate, discussion about what's working and what's not. And, if it was as simple as taking computers out of classrooms, then you would expect really poor schools where they don't have the luxury of wealthy schools and the IT labs and like that would actually have better outcomes, whereas we're not seeing that. I mean, in fact, in many ways, if you look at the PISA results, it's actually our top end that's being damaged, not... I mean, everything's falling, but it's actually been the top end of our students where performance is dropping off most noticeably. So that says to me there's something else going on. As to what it is, I think it's outside my area of expertise, other than to say it causes me considerable angst.
You made some interesting comments about inequality, and I think it's probably fair to say that if you're in the United States, the view would be that the US has become more unequal. In Australia, I think there's probably a similar view, but the evidence suggests that that's not the case. So how do you work that out in terms of public policy? If there's a perception that inequality is increasing here, how do you get across the fact that, according to statistics, it isn't?
Yeah, look, there's... so if you have a look at... so I talked in Australia in the context of quintiles, so 20% bytes. If you look at deciles in the United States, so there's slices of 10%, almost, it's the bottom 60% of males have lower real average hourly wages than they had, and I'll get the number wrong, but sort of roughly three decades ago. And where household incomes have gone up at the bottom end, it's entirely because of women coming into the workforce. So there has been a quite marked change in income inequality in the United States. In part because of our tax and transfer system, we've seen virtually no change in post-tax, post-transfer income inequality in Australia. But what we have seen is a very sharp rise in house prices. And that means that there's a change in perceptions about wealth inequality. And I think you see that concern showing up in people's concerns about how will my kids find the ability to buy a house. So I suspect, Jared, that's one of those, that's one of the factors that's feeding into the overall sense of concern. But if you look at one of the reasons why house prices have gone up, you can go back to issues around regulation too. A lot of it's around land use regulation, and a lot of it's around the fact that we have very little variation in the number of houses, that's meaning both standalone and apartments, notwithstanding variations in population growth over time.
Question here. Dr. Pattinson, you presided over, or been an observer of a pretty ugly Canberra scene for the last 5 years. To what extent do you think the politicians themselves are a big obstacle to digital progress and the kind of technical advance you're talking about?
I think they are no different to the rest of us. Our Prime Minister is an early adopter of technology. Uses it incredibly creatively. Others don't. I don't think they're any more or less, sort of a break on our adoption of technology than you or me or any bunch of Australians you can take collectively off the street.
Thanks, Dr. Parkinson. What your view is the appropriate level of government regulation for technology? And what I mean by that is for example, Uber and Uber having poor quality of working conditions for its worker and its drivers because it's a digital platform. Another example is artificial intelligence and, in particular, autonomous weapons. I read recently that a whole lot of scientists expressed great concern about the lack of regulation about autonomous weapons and where that could lead us. I suppose that's a bit dystopian, but my question really is, what's the appropriate level of government regulation of those technologies and how should we come to that decision?
You can never, I think, predetermine what the appropriate level of regulation is because when you try to do that, you end up in the world of black letter regulation. And what we know is whether you're talking about black letter law in the tax system or black letter regulation around competition in product markets, people will find a way around it. Far better to focus in on principles and think about the principles that you're trying to achieve and then continually go back and ask, is the legislative basis I've got actually consistent with delivering the outcomes that those principles are trying to achieve? So I think that's the way I'd approach it. It's the way I think about tax law. It's the way I think about regulation more generally. And when you look forward, I don't think any of that changes.
There's a question here, Dimitri.
Dr. Parkinson, thank you. Briefly on house prices, you forgot to mention the Friends on Martin Place, the central bank's contribution to that. But on the theme of education, as a sample, about my question is about federalism and what's going on federalism reform. We have a system that essentially, incentivizes centralization and standardization and rewards, in some respects, bad policy decisions by the states through the GST and the Commonwealth Grants Commission. Where do you see reform in that area to incentivize greater competition between the states and better policy outcome at the local and the state level?
I think it's fair to say that the Secretary of the Department, he's not a politician, so you can answer that as you choose, but I think it's more a political question, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's a political question. I think the only comment I'd make is the Prime Minister is fond of mentioning comment that a friend of his made, which was complaining about Australian states is like complaining about the mountains of Switzerland. They're there. It's in our constitution. The challenge for us all the time is to make the process work as well as we can. And how that gets manifest will be different at different times, depending on economic circumstances, economic imperatives, and frankly, the state of the political cycle in different jurisdictions. So I just leave it at that.
Fred?
Thank you for your comments, Dr. Parkinson. Sometimes knee-jerk reactions to one problem cause many more.
Yeah, it's the law.
And I decide 457 change is one of them. You referred in your speech to the need for us to get the best and brightest from around the world, to enable the transfer of technology and to boost our companies and all the rest of it. And now we've had a positive disincentive for people who are academics or entrepreneurs to come to Australia because they can't bring their family and get to stay because of the change in those policies. How do we prevent those sort of bad decisions and how do we fix them, particularly for the need to get these best and brightest here?
Well, this is up to the Secretary, but I think that's a question you might address to the Minister for Immigration.
So I'm going to stay away from the politics of it, but just to take that concrete example, people basically came and spoke with me, spoke with politicians, explained what the consequences were, and you've seen a number of mitigants put in place. And the more that people are able to keep bringing examples of unintended consequences, whether it's in this area or any other area, you know, responsive government will, you know, attempt to try and fix those things.
Yes, hi. I had a question about, you mentioned before Airbnb and Uber as disruptive technologies or disruptive companies. Some of these companies like Uber or Airbnb were operating in areas that were either gray areas because they were dealing with regulations that were in place far before these technologies were even conceived by anyone, or they were operating in breach of whatever those regulations were. Now, these companies obviously decided they were going to push the boundaries, right, and test some of those regulations and test some of those old laws and regulations to give an opportunity for the regulator to catch up. Mm-hmm. And I was just curious, is that fair play? Is that what you would expect disruptive industries to be doing, to be testing the boundaries and, in a sense, forcing the regulator to catch up?
Yeah. I would, because that's what happens. And it's not just about technology. It's actually, it's what happens in all sorts of areas that people, and it goes back to the question the gentleman asked over here. Once you get into the world of black letter law about how you're regulating, then people have an incentive to innovate around it. And that innovation can be good for society or it can be bad for society. Innovation is not inherently, there's not a value judgment associated with it. You always expect that, you know, when there is a change, it's going to clash. Remember, you know, you will have all seen the photos of when the steam locomotives were first available. You know, person would be walking along the track holding the flag, or they'd be walking along in front of the car holding the flag in order to stop the car going faster or the train going faster. And these were the reactions to people thinking, oh, well, you're trying to get around some form of regulation, whether it's written down in the law or whether it's a social acceptance of certain behaviours. And I think it's inevitable that that's how things get changed, because you need people to think differently about issues. But then as a society, you've got to balance that up against the broader set of issues about where's this leaving a social compact. Now, you could always say, I can't change anything because a social compact will be damaged. Well, then you'll end up very quickly with an uncompetitive economy with low wages, low job prospects, and that will force you into a set of changes. And I'll just labour this point for a moment. Those of us who were around in the 70s and 80s, you know, that's why we launched the huge reform program in Australia. We had lost a decade between the 74 downturn and the 83 recession. There was a perspective that Australia was being left behind because we weren't open, we weren't changing the way in which we did things. Lee Kuan Yew referred to us on the pathway to being poor white trash of Asia. If we'd said we can never touch social compact, then the Labor Party wouldn't have come up with the accord. The dries in the Liberal Party wouldn't have been pushing for more deregulation, both product and labour markets. No one would have basically said, well, we should float the dollar. So there's always going to be that tension. So it's not a good thing or a bad thing, it's just a thing.
We don't have a lot of time, so we've got two quick questions. One there, and a final one here. Okay. Yes, got to be quick.
Alan Locke, Dr. Patterson. Given the enthusiasm of the Prime Minister and your obvious interest, can you outline what's happening to improve the efficiency and effectiveness of the Commonwealth Public Service?
What a ripper of a question, Alan. How long you got? No, look, There are a range of things. We've got a modernisation fund which we're using to try and drive through significant change in a range of areas. Now, there are some things which you can think of as just how do you get your costs down and deliver more efficient services, such as shared services, things like that. But the really big payoffs we think of in terms of improving the outcomes for people go to things like the social investment program, the looking at the actuarially what's the right place to intervene for different groups in the community. A classic example is if a young carer, if a person is a carer at a young age, the chances of them getting off welfare over their entire life is very, very low. Whereas if you can intervene at a particular point in time and help get them into a job, you change not only the cost, but you change the entire set of life choices that that person has in front of them. But we're also doing things. There's something called DIPA. It's the data integration project where we're basically trying to bring together all of our data sets, put them into forms which researchers and others can use, so that we can actually have a whole pile of people. So it's the power of the crowd. A whole pile of people looking at evaluating programs and policies and say, is that really working? Or, you know, have you thought about doing it differently? So there's a range of things that I could talk about, but I'm conscious of the time, so I won't. But yeah, there's a lot of work going on, even though not a lot of it has a high public profile.
Final question.
Dr. Parkinson, referring to your earlier comments about the importance of data and drawing on your previous hat as Treasury Secretary, I'm wondering if you can speak to the role of data in providing evidence base to guide private investments. Are we there, or is there a way to go from that perspective?
Oh, no, we're definitely not there. We have made significant progress. So, for example, the role of Infrastructure Australia and conducting cost-benefit analysis based on robust data and business cases is improving the sorts of infrastructure investment decisions we're making. But this is a new phenomenon. Social welfare approach that I mentioned a moment ago is really just in its early days, but already we're seeing significant payoff. DIPA, the Data Integration Project, is really only just getting up and running now. And we, in fact, in PM&C released our evaluation program around Indigenous Affairs only a couple of weeks ago, which is the first time anybody has attempted to put a rigorous evaluation framework grounded in data around Indigenous affairs, because if we're really serious about empowering communities and doing things with Aboriginal communities and not to them, then you've got to basically have data that helps those communities make decisions. So in a whole variety of areas, we're starting. In no area would I say that we're mature. So there's a lot still to be done, but I'm a lot more optimistic today, for example, about the prospects here than I would have been, say, 5 or 10 years ago.
Many thanks. There are a lot of people here tonight, so I'll be as quick as I can be. Look, it's great to have Dr. Parkinson along here tonight, giving a very informative paper with a lot of empirical data in it. It says a lot of Australia that we have such good quality in Australian public service. I mean, I think the great reforms in Australia over the last 30 years, a lot of politicians have got due acknowledgement for that, a lot of businesses have, a lot of individuals have, and sometimes we overlook the quality of the public service that we've had during that period and before. And so we've
you have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia.
Tonight, which we can reflect on. But for now, thank you and well done.